Welcome to the Inspiring Women Interviews podcast, where you'll hear from inspirational female leaders who are real models as well as role models. Our guests on this show have one thing in common. They are passionate about supporting all women to achieve success. Here's your host, Amanda Alexander, multi-award-winning coach and founder of the Academy for Talented Women.
Hi, this is Amanda Alexander, and today I'm interviewing Vicky Cooper, Acquisition Sales Leader at IBM UK. Vicky is not only the Acquisition Sales Leader at IBM, she is also the founder of Connecting Women at IBM, the network supporting women within IBM. She's also a founder member of Connecting Women in Technology, a cross-industry support group for women in technology. So we'll be talking a lot about women in technology today, on how we support women, on how we close the gender pay gap, particularly within technology. But we'll also be talking about balance, because Vicky, not only as being sales leader at IBM for acquisitions, is a mum of four children. So Vicky, with that in mind, we were talking before we started recording about your Charles de Gaulle moment. So welcome, and please can you tell us about that Charles de Gaulle moment and what it meant for you?
Sure, thanks very much, Amanda. Well, I think it was probably about 10 years into my career. I had two children under five at the time, and I had quite a big role across Europe, and I was getting to the point where I was all work and no play. I'd really got to a stage where my career was really had taken off, and it was crazy. It was absolutely crazy. And I refer to my Charles de Gaulle moment as a point in which, on a Friday evening, and it was in November and it was an absolutely dark and horrible night, I was stuck at Charles de Gaulle Airport in Paris trying to get home Friday night late. And I really look back and I can remember now feeling very, very tired and worn out, really worn out. And I really resolved from that point onwards to change things. I'd got to the point where I'd had enough. So I wanted to change things for the better, and I wanted to get more balance into my work and my life as a whole, really.
So how did you do that?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually quite a tough thing to do. You can't really do these things quickly, but I made a number of promises to myself. And the first one was that I would only take, from that point onwards, UKI roles, UK and Ireland roles, okay? So that would mean I would only be away potentially for one night, and I'm probably not any night at all from the family. So I would particularly be much more likelihood to be always at home at night. And that really set me into another set of roles that revolved around much more of a UK-centric career.
Up until that point, you said you were 10 years into your career and it had been all work and no play. You had two children at that point. You're both under five. How had you actually managed with two young children under five with that all work and no play?
Well, I think to that point, I decided earlier on that I needed help, so I did have a nanny. And as I had a couple more children as they came through, I did have an au pair as well. Mm-hmm. So I threw resource at the problem, okay? And I managed at home in the way that I managed at work. You know, I managed teams, I delegated a lot, I made mm-hmm. sure that things were on track. So that was the main way I did it. I've always been very fortunate. IBM has been very good at providing flexible working. And so most weeks, I've always been able to work at home on a Friday now. And that's really made a huge difference to what I can get done, how I feel about working, and my ability to be able to manage my home life as well as my work. And at any stage, if we do have to work late, you can work from home late, which feels a lot more comfortable.
Yeah, and I'm interested that you said working at home on a Friday has made a huge difference to the way you feel. And I think that's really important, isn't it? It's about how you feel.
Yeah, it absolutely right. It is. And even if, you know, it might not happen every Friday, you know, and I do plenty of meetings on a Friday, but it's almost a principle that you are, you know, trying to work to, so that you don't burn out, really, and so that you've got that little bit of extra that you can fall back on.
Yes, it does help, doesn't it, being at home, just cutting out the travel and being able to kind of sneak in the little bits that seep into everybody's life whilst you're working as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, I cannot remember, though, a time where I've had to be in the office from 9 to 5. There's never been a time in my working life in the IT industry where I've had to be at a desk for a particular time. We've always had that flexibility, and it's made a huge difference.
And before IBM, how did you grow your career in technology?
Well, I did a degree in business management initially. I joined ICL and did my graduate training at ICL, always focused on a sales role. I worked for IBM as part of my degree as an intern, and I'd always wanted to come back into IBM, but I'd never really found the opportunity to do so since IBM weren't hiring graduates at the time that I graduated. So I went to a competition, stayed there for a couple of years, and then I felt very pleased with myself as I managed. I sat down one weekend and in a frenzy almost wrote to the competition and wanted to get another role, and I managed to land a role at IBM. Really through persistence and tenacity, I was very focused on trying to ensure that I got the right role, and I was hired as an experienced sales hire, although I'd only done 2 years experience, and I actually came into IBM and managed then to grow into much more senior roles and grow in firstly starting in the hardware business, then services, and latterly in software, which is where I am now.
Okay. I'm going to ask you about persistence and tenacity, but before I do, I've got to say, I started off my career as an ICL graduate trainee as well.
There you go. It was actually a very good course. Very good course.
It was a very good course, yeah. So persistence and tenacity, what does that, you say through persistence and tenacity you got into IBM, but in real terms, what did that mean? What did you actually do to show them that you were persistent?
Well, it was interesting. Yeah, it was interesting. They rejected me first time around. IBM rejected me. And I looked at this rejection letter and I could see no reason for rejection. And they didn't give me a reason. So I phoned up the HR lady who was at the bottom of this letter and I said, can you tell me why you've rejected me? She could not answer me. And I said, well, I'm working for your competition. I can do this, this, and this. We've just launched a Unix hardware box at the time. And in fact, that's exactly where IBM were about to launch a system into the open systems market. And so I said, well, you'd be crazy not to look at my CV. And this lady agreed with me, and she put my CV out to a number of line managers. And I think it was something like 6 interviews later, I managed to land a role. So, yeah.
6 interviews. Wow.
It was ridiculous. It was quite ridiculous, but got there in the end. And that's where the tenacity comes in this game.
Well, that is a great story, because how many people would actually call the HR department and say, why have you rejected me? And I wonder if they did, how many would have got a different result as you did?
I don't know. I think maybe it's just worth checking these things. It's worth asking the question. I don't think at the time due diligence had been done on me as a candidate. Now, maybe more due diligence is done today, but you don't ask, you don't get, right?
So has that attitude of not accepting, not necessarily taking no for an answer, has that attitude sort of, and that quality of just, okay, let's just see what else is here, has that followed you throughout your career in sales?
It has, because it's normally not the first answer which is the right answer. Okay? And it doesn't matter whether you're, no, it's true. I mean, it doesn't matter whether you're dealing with a client in a particular bid situation, a particular, you know, or a situation where you're trying to, where you're interviewing for a particular role and trying to encourage a candidate to join your team, or whether you're going for a promotion. Normally, you know, there's something else going on. So you need to be, I think, a little bit more persistent and to answer the question of why and what else is there behind this. Because normally that there is other things going on that you probably don't know about unless you ask those questions. Yeah, so that is actually a theme.
And have you had any other times throughout your career that you can recall, I'm putting you on the spot here, where you have not taken no for an answer, that you've followed through and it's resulted in some sort of success?
Yes, I can remember, I don't often get emotional. I can remember only twice in my career getting emotional. And it's normally in situation where, you know, it was desperately, I thought at the time, unfair. And, you know, I actually was looking for a promotion. I wanted to get through to the next band. And my boss was being quite laid back about it. He was being quite, avoiding the question. And I can remember very clearly arguing with him and putting a very logical argument in place, in fact, as to why I would be good in the role and why I deserve the promotion, right? And I did get emotional, walked out of the office, slammed the door, had a good, you know, cry in the corner, came back in, and actually he listened. He decided that I had a fair point and I'd made a good enough argument, because he didn't realize a number of things that probably I should have told him in advance in a more constructive way. But it all sort of came out with me explaining in vast detail, you know, what needed to be just spoken about at that time. So I think that really, really has helped me, that sort of approach.
Thank you for that. I wanted to ask you, so we've talked about your first sort of 10 years into the career and then that Charles de Gaulle moment. And I just wanted to rewind back and just ask you about the children. So you've got four children, Hannah, Alexander, Natasha and Sebastian. How old are they now?
19 down to 13.
So you have four teenagers.
Yes, I do.
Wow.
At the moment. Yes, no, they're great though. They are really self-sufficient, which is fantastic, because I'd always said that if there was a problem with any of them, I would put them first. You know what I mean? If they had an illness or an issue or a problem, I would have changed my career. But as it happens, I think, you know, I then not needed to do that, not needed to make those decisions, fortunately enough. But what I have been able to do, and I, you know, constantly sort of remind, you know, or reiterate this to them, that I wanted to be a role model to them. Yeah. Because I think it's very important to have role models and to be able to see how, you know, what's the art of the possible. And so I was keen to do that. And part of that was working and continue to work throughout my career on a full-time basis, really.
And did they ever talk to you about how you have been a role model to them? Have you seen the impact on your children and in what they're going, at ages of 13 to 19, they'll be thinking about their careers now, I guess.
No, they are. We have this conversation only at the weekend, actually, because they are starting to think that they can take the responsibility, both the girls and the boys. It's not just a girl thing, because there's two boys and two girls. So, you know, they both understand that they need to be responsible financially for themselves, and they need to understand that it's not, you know, an optional thing. It's something that needs to be, it is good for you, and it's a positive thing. And you know, we are here to do some sort of work and some sort of, you know, good in this world. So that's really where we're coming from.
So they've got those values of contribution and putting into the world.
Yeah, I think they're getting there. They're not, you know, they are teenagers, remember. It's going to take a few more to actually understand it. But yeah, I can see the green shoots of that sort of thinking going on. So that's good.
Do you still have a nanny, or how does it work now when you're kind of working and you're obviously, I'm guessing you're still not flying around after that 12 degree
no, I'm not flying, fortunately, and haven't done for many years on a regular basis anyway. And but what's working now is my husband runs his business from home, so he does a few kiddie runs in terms of activities and things like that. They are pretty self-sufficient, but there are still, you know, a few runs that they need to do. My daughter, age 16, is a national level. She performs national level gymnastics, so she trains 16 hours a week. So there's still those sorts of activities to get them to, and I have a cleaner, and I have had au pairs, but they come and go, so it depends on, you know, how I'm feeling as to whether that works or not. But mostly in the last few years, it has been around au pairs and cleaners that help me out, so I don't have to do absolutely everything myself. But also the kids have got to do their chores as well, so that's the way it works.
Oh, so I'm very interested to know how you get the kids to do their chores.
Well, it's a lifelong battle, I think, but they're certainly better at it than they used to be. And, you know, I think as they get older, they get a little bit more mature, they do start to understand they need to do a few things. So, yes, they will help if asked, typically now, which is good, rather than ignoring the subject. But, yes, I don't think you ever win that battle entirely.
Yeah, I don't think I've met anyone. No, I don't think I've met anybody yet who has children who quietly get on with a job regularly, you know, without being asked.
No, it doesn't happen, I don't think. Certainly not with my children, anyway.
They might exist somewhere, but no, I haven't come across them. I have a 14-year-old. He's very good, but, you know, he needs to be asked, and sometimes I get a response that's a little bit like, it sounds like a caveman human being.
Yeah,
Vicky,
exactly.
I wanted to ask you about the whole the outsourcing thing, because one of the things I think that women come up against is if they haven't achieved a level of seniority in their role, which evidently you had, or putting it bluntly, they haven't achieved a level in their career where they can get the help with childcare, for example, get the nanny or whatever. And we've all heard about the issues with the cost of childcare at the lower end of scale. But there's also, I think, a very real problem for professional women who are possibly, starting out in management or mid-level management, and their salary is not able to support them with the outsourcing they need. And the issue is that they go into a sort of vicious circle of getting completely frazzled, trying to grow their career, and also trying to have to do everything at home as well. I'm interested to know what you think about that. What is it that we can do about that? Because I do see this as a very real issue for women kind of stuck in the middle.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I think there is an issue. I have always been quite, really discerning around what help and childcare I choose. So I would always be really quite clear about the criteria for a nanny or an au pair, or even a cleaner, anyone that comes into the house. I know exactly what I'm looking for, and sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't work out, and if it doesn't work out, move on, nip it in the bud, move on, because things won't change very easily. Normally, it's better to make a fast decision and admit that you've made a mistake if you have done that. But I think we still tend to be very cautious. A lot of people I know are very cautious about au pairs. They're foreign. They don't understand my children. They won't, they can't communicate very well, etc., etc. I think we've got to be more flexible. I think many au pairs that I have had have been more than capable. Their English might not be perfect, but they are very intelligent. They learn fast. If you work with them and help them and build their confidence, then they can be fantastic. And, I've had au pairs that stayed with me for 2 to 3 years sometimes. So it just depends on how you work with them. But it also means that you do have to take a bit of a risk. So not everybody is ultimately qualified. An au pair is not qualified. A nanny is qualified, of course. So it's that balance between the two, and being as flexible as possible around your childcare solutions, which means that ultimately it's as cheap as possible as well. Because, an au pair is much more cheap. But you do have to have a room for them. Right? So you have to have an au pair is live-in, so you have to have a room for them in your house or nearby. So, it can be difficult, but I think we do tend to be very bit precious, a little bit, black and white about the fact they must be this and they must be that. I think if we can be more flexible, encourage people to take the responsibility, because often if they've had brothers and sisters, they've looked after brothers and sisters, they're fairly capable, that they're intelligent because they're in the middle of a university course or they've done a university course, then you're in pretty good shape there. You are in pretty good shape, and you can spot it if there's a problem, and you can nip it in the bud. That's the way I've worked, and on the basis of which I've done it, and that's been for me quite a good way of doing it. But you do have to be you have to manage them properly, really.
Again, it's another management role for you to take on.
I say it all the time. I manage at home, I manage at work. That's the way it is. I don't think you can do this sort of thing unless you're happy with that, really. It's very difficult.
I remember when I was in IT having we moved house, and Max was 6 months old and I was coming back from maternity leave, and I found a childminder who I thought was, I was very, very happy with, very comfortable with. But the problem that we couldn't figure out was that the childminder's hours, which I think were, I can't remember, probably 8 o'clock or 7:30 till 6 o'clock, did not cover me for my hours plus travel. So there's no, there was no way that if I was traveling to my office every day which was about an hour's drive away, down the M56, that I could get back to pick Max up in time. And so my solution to that was to apply for flexible working and to ask if I could work from home. And the response was, you'll laugh at this. There's no such thing as a part-time project manager. And no, you can't work from home because that would be setting a precedent.
Oh, hard work, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think it comes back to what we were saying earlier before we started recording the interview. You were talking about how important it is to choose your manager.
Yeah, no, that is really a very important thing. And that's not always possible, of course, and I appreciate that. But I do encourage anyone to try and do that. If you've got an opportunity, then choose. And choose your manager almost as important as your role. Yeah?
I agree. And you say it's not always possible, but I have seen so many times with people who are miserable in their career, and it seems to me, I would say they are miserable in their career, and I'd say about 70% or 80% of the time they're miserable in their career because of the manager that they have. And I think when it gets to that point, whether it's to do with your work-life balance, or whether it's to do with feeling valued, or whether it's to feel that you're not, you know, any other reason, if you have a manager who is toxic or who's not forward-thinking, or, you know, for any number of reasons, then it is time to look for a new manager, whether that's in the organization or outside the organization, because there's
Absolutely.
Not really much you can do. You can't change them, can you?
No, you can't change them, but I have been in a situation where I have actually had to put up with it for a few months, for half a year or whatever it is, in order to then another reorganization comes around the corner and you can start to influence where you report in, what you do, etc. So sometimes you have to bide your time depending on where you are in the year and what's happening in the organisation. But I think it's definitely, you have to have a plan. You definitely have to have a plan, and always have a plan B. You're on one line of thinking, but at any time, especially in IT, there's always the opportunities and transformations happen all the time. The business organizes transforms every 6 months in IBM. So, you know, you really have to make sure that you've got a plan B. You know, if this plan A, that the job that I'm doing now in the organization I'm doing now, were to fail for some reason, which is possible, then what would I do? And that's the plan B, and that's the way I've worked, certainly in the last 15 years, I would say, because it's been essential to have some other ways of looking at things, and another option.
It goes back to the way you feel, I guess, and if you feel that there's a way out, and you've got your cunning plan in the background, if it all goes to hell in the handcart, then it's always easier to deal with a difficult situation in the present for a period of time.
Yes, exactly. Because you know you can press the button any other time because you've got options.
Yes. Options are a great freer of creativity, I think.
Yeah,
Vicky, I know you do a lot of work supporting gender diversity initiatives. And I wanted to ask you about Connecting Women at IBM that you founded in, was it 2009?
Yeah, that's right. We've been going for a while now, yeah.
And did you have a specific mission when you started Connecting Women?
I think, to be fair, we knew that we wanted to create a network where women felt safe to vent, to have an environment in which they could talk about work issues and get advice and guidance from mentors in the business who understand the situation they've been in. So that was the first thinking. And then I think it's developed over time, and you know, it's got a little bit more sophisticated as a way of also providing personal development opportunities and networking, really, understanding where the next role could be. So that's really added to the strength of the network over the net, you know, over time.
And how many members do you have in Connecting Women now?
Well, on a regular basis, we will have, we operate it by office. So by region, you know, Scotland, Manchester, Leeds, Warwick, London, etc. So, you know, there's about 12 or so locations which are operated by a location leader. And typically, if we have an event all together, then we can have anywhere from 300 to 500 people attend. We do a lot of online events. But we are able to contact and have as part of the network, the email, everyone in the UK, all women in the UK, which is about 5,000. Okay, so we email everyone and we end up having probably, I'd say, about 20% of those who are regular attendees, and they understand that they what the network's there for and how it can support them in their careers. So it varies according to the subject in terms of how many members we have and who who attends and what level and what seniority. It really does depend on the sophistication of the product and the subject area we're talking about. But I was just going to say, but it is very well supported, which is fantastic to see, and still has a role today. Increasingly, as the other diversity constituents do with the other networks in the UK as well, so we link up with them quite a bit now.
Within Connecting Women, and also within your role that I actually forgot to mention as a member of the UK Women's Leadership Team for gender diversity within IBM, relating that to the gender pay gap, which has been in the news a lot recently. A study from Deloitte said it's going to take 50 years to close it in the UK, and then the World Economic Forum said that it's going to take 171 years globally, which is up from 118 years. Obviously, you're kind of at the center of supporting gender diversity within technology. What is it that we're doing? I guess I want to ask, where is it we're not quite getting it right yet?
I think there are a couple of areas. Firstly, we are still not making the IT sector attractive to women. I think it's still seen as geeky and a bit boring, and despite the fact everyone's got a mobile phone, they still don't relate it to the fact that this is the world we're in now. It's much more of a consumer-led world, and much more mobility and much more apps driven than it ever has been. Even business to business IT is going much more that way. So I think we're not doing a good enough job in getting across the career opportunities there are to women, and the opportunities we've got, which are broad and exciting and really, you know, developing all the time. So they're becoming very very exciting given the pace and the rate of change of technology. So I think that's one thing. And I think we're also, you know, it's a lot down to women's choices. And a lot of women, I think, you know, opt out. You know, they decide not to continue their work if they did have a professional role. after, you know, before children, do they continue? Some of them don't. And why is that? And what happens there? Well, you know, women I've spoken to, they genuinely aren't encouraged to stay. And I think there's a lot about something we can do from a an employer point of view to reach out to those women, to keep in touch with those women, to ensure that they understand that there isn't anything to be scared of here. You know, they've got an extra, you know, they've got more complications and more difficulties within their lives because they've chosen, you know, it is more complex having children and working. But there's nothing to be scared of. There's plenty of people who've done it and done it very successfully. So, you know, you sort of need to have a little bit of a, I guess, a ballsy attitude towards moving on and getting the place you want in your career. And I think if you've got that thick skin, you can really make some progress. But you have to take on the fight, really. Take on the role, yeah?
You do. It takes courage. And what I see a lot is...
Courage, yeah.
Yeah, women get frightened. And I think they get frightened that where they are now and the role that they are now is the only one. And if they move, then they will have undone the good work. And, you know, there's a certain loyalty. And I've seen it a lot with other people saying, but you're onto a good thing now. And if they want to expand, if they want to advance their career, it's that risk. It's that, well, can I afford to take that risk? You know, what about the mortgage?
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, it is tough, right? It's not easy to make that decision, but 9 times out of 10, there are enough people around to support you and, you know, give you advice that, you know, as long as you take advantage of the people around you and you really do hook in with and find role models, find people to talk to, I think you'll get the support if you reach out. That's been my experience.
For those people who are listening and who are perhaps thinking, well, I don't have anyone within my organisation to reach out to, what advice would you give them?
Find someone outside your organisation would be good. It doesn't matter. There are plenty of networking events around, too many almost. And I think there are plenty of women who are more senior who are willing to help and willing to give their time and give their advice. It's only, you know, really a phone call or an event away. You could start to build a relationship with somebody that could really make the difference. And I'd encourage anyone who's in that situation to do it. And outside the organization, sometimes it's a really good thing.
I think so too. And I tend to say to people, you know, just use LinkedIn. Start seeing who you like the sound of on LinkedIn. Yep, get that, because networking now can be done online before it's actually done in person.
Yep, it works. It works. It definitely does. And people are much more open if you are clear about what you are asking. Yeah. So even if someone asks me something, but I don't know who they are, as long as they're asking me in the way that makes huge amounts of sense to me, I know who they work for or what the situation is, or I can relate to it and I can help them, then that's fine. You know,
okay.
I would give them that support.
So what you're saying, be clear about what you're asking, is be very specific. I need some help to, you know, I want to change my career, I want to change the industry, want to... Can you help?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think we need to beat about the bush. It's really easy these days to have those, you know, you can in-message anyone you're linked in with. And it's hugely valuable. And I'm not sure it's really used as much as it should be as a platform, as a way of really moving. And I think more men than women use it. I don't know. I seem to get get a lot more of that sense at the moment. But I think we really do need to make sure that we've got use all the tools at our disposal. Yeah.
I think one of the things that gets in women's way is the, oh my gosh, what will other people think of me? They'll think I'm pushy. You know, that who am I? Who is little old me to contact that person? You know, who's a senior director? They'll never pay attention to me. So maybe you can reassure anyone listening to this as a senior director how you would handle somebody reaching out for help.
Well, I would suggest if someone articulates and it has to be short and easy to read and respond to. We don't want huge diatribes of messages going around, because I think that really is a bit of a put off. But if someone's clear about what they're looking for, then I think that's absolutely fine. And I would suggest go for it. Now, the worst could happen. What's the worst going to happen? Right? They don't respond.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the worst thing that could happen. But if you actually are really targeted about your question, you know, you link in to someone to say, you know, I see that you've got this particular expertise in big data or in, you know, the analytics business. You know, I'm trying to solve this particular problem, or I'm looking at, you know, work moving into that area. Would you prepare to, you know, have a phone call with me? Then I think that's a good way to progress. It's a good way to have a conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for that. Vicky, just before we wrap up, there was something that I wanted to ask you about related to attracting more girls into technology. I came across an article the other day, and it was about engineers, saying only 8% of engineers in the UK are women. And the article posed a really interesting solution at the end for attracting more girls into engineering, and it was about presenting an engineer career as problem solving to girls, because there was a theory there that, which I actually agree with, that girls like to focus on that purpose rather than on the how, on the process of it. Apparently one university is even created a degree in humanitarian engineering. So the focus is on sort of design. For example, as an engineer, you could design an affordable solution for clean drinking water. You could make a difference, you know, or for medical diagnostic equipment. That has shown that it's drawn women to the course. What do you think of that?
I think it sounds fabulous. I think we know that if we use the right wording in job adverts or in, you know, ways, the words that attract women, that we will get more women to apply. It's the same thing as you know, in trying to get women into engineering. It helps to have a female friendly set of words. And, you know, there's been a lot of work and studies done on this subject. And if it does appeal to that problem-solving side, the purpose, strategic sort of input, and also supporting, you know, humanity and our people who are less fortunate than ourselves, I think that's a huge, huge benefit. And I find that, you know, when I do, you know, use those sorts of wording or use something that really just appeals and is slightly less, I guess, less clinical, a little bit more female friendly, then it makes a big difference. So I think there's a lot to be said about, you know, using that sort of strategy for getting women into tech, because we really have still got a huge problem. And although, you know, IBM hires 50-50 men to women, that doesn't sustain throughout, as we know. So we need to have those sorts of strategies in place when we're building our reaching out to our schools and universities, etc. So I think it's a fantastic idea.
I like the idea about a female friendly set of words.
Yeah. Well, we know. So it does work.
Is that kind of avoiding jargon and again, as you said, it's focusing on the purpose, on the why, on the how you can help, rather than on a whole load of technical jargon and programming languages in a job advert. Is that what you mean by female-friendly set of words?
Yeah, I don't think I would suggest that we hide the skills that are required to do a particular role, because that would be, you know, incorrect. But, you know, I think we do need to make a job advert or, an engineering degree or something that we're trying to attract women into something that actually speaks to women, that uses their language, that reaches out to them in the way that touches them. That's what's important. And the more we know about how to do that, the better. We need to implement those strategies. I think they work. They definitely work.
Do you think we'll be able to close the gender pay gap in the UK in less than 50 years?
Yes. Because more men are on board with that than ever before. Yeah. So I think to have men as allies and men, supporting that cause is where I'm seeing things change. And gender pay gap is one area.
Yeah, I so agree. And I do think there's a lot of work to do to help men understand what gender equality means and what it means for them and how it will benefit them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I still think we've got a long way to go there, despite the fact that we've been banging on about it a long time. It always staggers me how many male leaders don't understand why we're having the conversation. They don't understand that more diverse teams are more successful. So if you have that diversity, you will get more success. You will increase your bottom line. And that we know that from all of the McKinsey studies that have been done since 2001, right? So it really is a story that needs to be understood and acknowledged by male leaders.
Yes, and it surprises me as well, especially when you talk in figures and the cold hard fact that it will increase your bottom line if you get a 50-50 male female split. And there's quite a few companies, especially Nordic companies, I believe, who've achieved that and have found that their bottom line has increased. Is that how you, when you're faced with that, is that what you do to try to educate those male leaders who aren't on board?
Yes, that's one strategy. The other strategy is to understand whether they've got daughters, which works quite well as well.
Tell me more. So if they do have daughters, what do you do? And
if they have daughters, then typically they will starting to come across the fact that it's not an even playing field, or not as even as they thought it was before they had daughters anyway. So you can normally understand and get a conversation and a dialogue going as you start to understand whether they are thinking about advising their daughters about, which career to go into, how to actually be successful. So that's another way of having the conversation.
Yes, that's a good one.
And when they don't have daughters. It also applies. If they don't have daughters, sometimes you can also get, have a conversation. I know our, certain senior leaders have got, autistic children, dyslexic children. That's a very, very common situation these days. And so if you can get to understand, what the person's situation is, sometimes you can have those conversations as well, because, it doesn't matter whether they, if there's any sort of, understanding of how the various different how teams should be made up and to be successful, then they will think about how they would employ their children, or maybe they've got nephews and nieces, or normally once you've had a conversation with someone for more than 10 or 15 minutes, you can understand that where a hook could possibly be. Tends to be over a cup of coffee or somewhere that's, at an event or something like that, where you've got a little bit more of a conversation opportunity.
And finding the hook.
Yeah, exactly.
Vicky, thank you very much. Thanks very much for being my guest today on the Inspiring Women Interviews podcast. Thank you for being inspiring. I've taken so much out of this interview, and I will speak to you soon.
Lovely. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Amanda. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Amanda Alexander's Inspiring Women Interviews podcast. While you're waiting for the next episode, visit AmandaAlexander.com and sign up free to Career Confidence 101, where you'll get 10 powerful coaching questions to help you know yourself, trust yourself, and step up to extraordinary success.